Revenge of the 80s Kids has been rated T for podcast.
Keep the space fighters in close formation. Stick to the plan, and the recapture of our vessel is a mathematical certainty. Sue's been upgraded with the latest tactical software and downloaded into an unobtainium-plated battle wagon, making her impervious to anything the Endeavour has in its arsenal. We distract the enemy by looking like we're about to make an attack dive, when in fact we're just flying in circles outside of their weapon range, providing a necessary distraction so that Sue can fly through the blind spot in their force field, breach the enemy's hull, and then scores of loyal 80s droids will board. Wipe out the bay bots, recapture our stolen vessel for us, and all we have to do is fly around in these flimsy unarmed fighters for a bit and have a lark. This was well worth weeks of meticulous planning. I confidently predict no problems. Oh, hang on. What's that big, ugly thing the Baybots are stuck on the back of the Endeavour? If I didn't know better, I'd say it looks like some kind of giant super cannon. I wonder what it really does. Fair enough.
Suggest something. I'm just trying to introduce a new way to express torment. Just give it a go. I'll go first, then you can follow me, okay? It goes. No, 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 no. It's pretty cool. I thought of it myself. Now you.
Whoever you are, I don't think this is the time to be trying to ruin classic movie tropes cherished since our childhood.
Don't be ridiculous. At Big Bay Studios, it is always time to ruin classic movie tropes many have cherished since their childhood.
As emotional as this moment is, I should point out that the Bay drones appear to have beaten us. We're completely surrounded.
Indeed you are, 80s kids. Indeed you are. Now you will feel the power of Big Bay and I, Deathly Buff, will have my revenge.
I'm sorry, have we met?
But have we met? What manner of insolence is this? Maybe you will feel differently when we meet. Face to face. Drones, escort these miserable wretches to the bridge. Finally, they will recognize the error they made all those years ago.
Well, that's it then. Looks like we're done.
This is terrible. Sue's been destroyed. Big Bay has stolen our ship, and Leo's gone dark. He's just mumbling something to himself over and over. Let's see what it is. Boost, amplifier, signal, and clean up white noise. I know all those years as an audio editor have failed from the end.
So good. So, so good. When we were married in 2009. Went to see District 9 at the pictures. Oh, those were good robots. Such good robots in 2009.
Oh dear, he's regressed into a fantasy world where it's 2009, thinking about cinema visits.
Ah yes, I went along to that. It was a good evening. We had Chinese food afterwards.
And I suppose my invitation was lost in the post, was it?
I believe you cried off something about having moved to Australia.
Yes, yes, but you were there in spirit, Ian.
My spirit is pretty bad at cruising the starter trays for more pancake rolls and barbecue ribs. So that's not much good, really, is it?
You should have been there, Ian. 2009 was such a magical time.
Was it, Leo? Was it really? Maybe we better sit down and discuss this.
If you get through the trauma, then maybe you'll be in your right mind in time for this Dearthler buff guy to torch us into insanity. So, 2009.
Yes, indeed, it would seem that maybe my mind is not all that it once was. For here I am, considering calling 2009 a magical time, but was it? Was it indeed? Well, we're about to find out, for we are the 80s kids, and while we slowly drift along towards our death, what better thing to do than discuss the films of 2009? But I am not alone in this discussion, no. Joining me tonight are...
I am Ian, here for the final year show, but I'm not alone, for at my side I have...
Justin, I might not have been here for the entire duration, but I'm certainly here for the end.
So here we are. The first thing we're going to get out of the way right away, because it goes nowhere else in any of the other lists, is that 2009 is the year that Terry Gilliam brought out the much-troubled Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Now, saying a Terry Gilliam film is much-troubled is like saying Terry Gilliam made a film. I can't even bring myself to say that this one was particularly troubled, even though one of its main characters died halfway through filming. That apparently is not enough to stop the film.
Half of the course in the Gilliam film, isn't it?
Yes, so there we go. I looked forward to it. I have to say that I think the Zero Theorem is more the kind of thing that I like. Still not 100%, but it was interesting, certainly. Did you see this, Justin?
Yeah, it was interesting. It's not one of my favourite ones, I have to say. But, you know, you're always in for a dazzling theatrical experience with Gilliam. So it's certainly pleasing to the palate, to the eyes. I mean, the story does, in fact, can survive, you know, people being replaced because it's so kind of strange. I just found it a bit confusing, really, yeah. As a kind of mass, really. It's like that didn't really help.
I think there's a thing like Time Bandits, by contrast, has a sense of crazy magic about it. Now, it could be that because obviously I think possibly a lot of that gets infused post-production, like it has to be made in a particular way. I think Gilliam just wanted to sort of get shot, you know, finish it and get it out, because it is incredibly depressing to have one of your actors pass away during filming when you're all wrapped up in that intense process. And so I think there was a certain effort to which they wanted to finish it to honour Heath Ledger, but that at the same time, he didn't quite have enough of the magic dust. I mean, it is particularly incoherent, even for Terry Gilliam.
Yes.
So there we go. I take it you've probably not seen it, Ian.
No, this is the period of time where really I was only seeing the big tentpole movies, and I wasn't renting DVDs, and I wasn't watching much television. So this is the great black hole is opening up in my film knowledge here, but there's a few things to be said about this year.
I would say that, although I don't think me and Justin have done a good job of really recommending that it's a must see, I think it is a sort of, any Gilliam film really is worth seeing once for seeing.
My favourite is not, it is not, you know, diminishing it in its, you know, worth of watching. Check it out. Absolutely.
How do they work around the Heath Ledger being dead issue?
Yeah, I mean, it has a dreamlike quality to it, and it works. It does work, but as I say, adds to, as they were saying, the general incoherence of it. But yes, they get away with it.
Yeah, there was a slight rewrite where a thing where the Heath Ledger character is kind of, I think, romantic with one of the other characters, and the way that they get around it is to say, well, she wants him to be someone else. So in the Imaginarium, he is a number of different people, a number of other different actors who I think agreed to go kind of either lowly credited or uncredited, took the place of Heath Ledger in those sequences because it's meant to be Heath Ledger's character. So I had to get out of the way because there really was nowhere else to put it. But now let's get down to the list. And there are many questions. I think this is what I found. Carving up the 2009 turkey, it does leave you with a lot of questions. First of it, other than that, was it a good year to be a? And we're going to give a number of things that it could have been a good year to be a this or another. For a start, there were a lot of children's movies in 2009. So just to give you the rundown, we have Nine, Aliens in the Attic, Astro Boy, Cirque de Freak, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, Coraline, Dragon Ball Evolution, G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, Inkheart, Monsters vs. Aliens, Night at the Museum, Battle of the Smithsonian, Planet 51,
Ponyo, Race to Witch Mountain, Secret of Moonacre, Up, and Shia LaBeouf noise. Transformers Revenge of the Fallen. I've relegated Transformers to a children's movie because, well, it's a toy line movie and there's not much content in it for anyone else. So it goes there. It's not in action or sci-fi.
I think only young people with no understanding what a film should actually be like will appreciate Transformers.
But in terms of, like, you know, was it good for a child? Wow, there's some dark stuff here, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, this is the thing, you will find as we go through the list, it's a very confusing year for fans of various things and for children, because that's quite a lot. It's quite a big slate of things which are aimed at various types of children.
Yeah.
I mean, let's take a moment to talk about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. My experience of this as the resident Harry Potter Luddite. Oh, the last Harry Potter film that we dealt with was to my mind, the one which was like, well, that kind of happens. It's there. This one is not, because this one's winding up for the end. And so it becomes, everybody knows what they're doing. This is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. There it is. Off you go. And benefits, of course, from having what Komodo may have termed the unfortunate event as a sort of locus or centre of the events that transpire. It's burdened somewhat with its responsibility of being after all the others and before the end. But I think it does the job, really.
It does. And to be honest, the book is exactly the same. Like, as you're reading the book, you know that, you know, this is merely just the beginning of the end. And then obviously, it's fulfilled in the last one.
You say winding up to the end. It isn't winding up to the end. It's not even the penultimate movie.
Well, I'm kind of including the last two films as one thing for the sake of the story.
Yeah.
As the book, you know, that there's one more book to come. So you're very much like, okay, we'll just get through this bit. There's some investigative stuff that needs to happen to lay the groundwork for the payoff at the end. It's the same feeling. You're like, and I know there's two more films to come. You are getting ready to go, okay, this needs to happen first.
But I would.
So it replicates that, fine. You know, it's like, it is what it is.
I wouldn't even count this as their darkest hour. I think the first half of Deathly Hallows is darker.
The thing is, by this stage, you know, we've got the director who's staying on board and he knows what he's doing and it's fine. You know, it's like they've worked out how to do it now. They've worked out how to cut things so they don't have to include everything in the book. So it's pretty much like, okay, this needs to be done and it's fine. It's perfectly valid, you know, as a film. But, you know, what we're really wanting for is the big finale. So it's always going to suffer from that. And the book is exactly the same.
I haven't read Half-Blood Prince, but I do read Wikipedia pages, like, you know, specialised Wikipedia pages to absorb lots of background information, because I love that kind of thing. Is it very clear to the uninitiated, you know, person who hasn't read the book, the muggles of the viewers, that the Half-Blood Prince is Snape? And why he's called Half-Blood Prince, for that matter? Is it clear? I don't think it was at all.
Yeah, it's clear in the books. Everything's much clearer in the books. I mean, you know, you always sacrifice a certain amount of clarity for the films.
I have to say, as someone who doesn't read specialist Wikipedia pages and all of this kind of stuff, I know that the Half-Blood Prince is Snape. I've kind of inhaled that through culture somehow, somewhere along the line. As to why, well, I kind of know that's something to do with him being half muggle or something. As to why he's a prince, maybe it's because he recorded such hits as 1999 and Raspberry Beret, but I'm not really sure.
He's the teacher of dark arts, formerly known, of potions, formerly known as.
Yes, exactly. I don't think it really matters. I mean, does it?
It's meant to, that when you start reading it, you're meant to think that it's something else. And so then, you know, it's...
I never thought it was something else either.
But it's meant to have a little bit of mystery until you kind of go, oh, okay, right.
Yeah. Philip,
that's assuming that you haven't looked and checked everything out
just
beforehand.
To pull the scales from your eyes, yes, he is half-blood, he is half-muggle, but his mother was pure-blood and the mother's maiden name is Prince, so he's the half-blood prince.
Oh, I see. Surname. Right. Well, I can see how that got past me, being as that's fairly mundane. But there we go. Okay, cool. I think the thing that comes out of that discussion really is that adaptations of big novel series are clearly tricky. And in fact, it does lead to the supposition for all you Game of Thrones fans that not knowing what the end of the book series is due to the fact George R. R. Martin is still waiting on that delivery of pencils, which, you know, we're getting a pencil watch is still continuing. Oh,
don't get me started on Game of Thrones right now.
I'm not really going to, but the point is, it might be better that that finishes as a television series before it finishes as a set of books. Because I think if you see the end of a television series, then having a different ending in a series of books will make the books just as exciting. But then if you did it the other way around, for some reason culturally we see it that if the book ended one way and the film ends another, well, the film ruined the ending, didn't it? I mean, that's the way that people generally see it, not it's something different. And I think there is this whole thing of, well, you know, Harry Potter did the job. It's there. It exists. And that's not how people want you to think about your film. They were, oh, I was on the edge of my seat right until the end. But I think that was kind of an impossible task. And I think, in fact, Harry Potter's last three outings at the cinema benefited enormously from probably having a director who kind of went, well, nobody's ever going to see these as well. They're so exciting. I paid for the whole seat, but I only needed the edge. They're just going to go, yep, that works. So let's go for that. And, yeah. And I think that's great. If he'd fought against that, it could have ruined the whole thing. And kudos to someone for agreeing to produce an incredibly difficult project of that sort.
Yeah, absolutely.
So other things to pick out here. Aliens in the Attic was terrible. Astro Boy, I want to see, but, I missed my chance when it was on television last, and you can't get it anywhere else. So, but it looked from the 5 minutes of it I've seen, it looks really mad and interesting. Cirque de Freak is really mad and interesting.
Yeah, it was fun.
Really good, fun film. Didn't do well at the box office. And so was passed over for further opportunity. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is the funniest thing I saw at cinema. Yeah. That year, and Phil Lord and Christopher Miller are genii of a rare comic type who have, you know, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, both Jump Street movies, the Lego movie, and a sequel to Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I mean, these guys know how to turn a gag, so, you know, that's great stuff. Coraline is yet another interesting failure from the mind of Neil Gaiman. Imagine Neil Gaiman and Terry Gilliam made a movie together.
Mm-hmm.
Blimey. That would be a strange night at the cinema. Dragon Ball Evolution, less said about that, the better. I'll come back to G.I. Joe in a minute, for I have a couple of things to say. Inkheart was just, ink heartbreaking. It looked as if it would be good, and then it wasn't. Monsters vs. Aliens was perfectly adequate, and one of the few times I've been to the cinema to see 3D, and it wasn't mind-meltingly annoying, but then it is an animation that was made to be seen in 3D in the first instance, and it's a perfectly decent movie. I don't think the 3D adds anything. It's just, it was fine. Night at the Museum is, well, more Night at the Museum. A very long movie for something that is just a bit of fluff about museum exhibits coming to life. Planet 51 is a ropey CG animation, which has some nice gags in it, and all the vocal performance you might expect from Dwayne Johnson. If you can't see Dwayne Johnson, he is necessarily diminished, for he is a physical presence and not a vocal one. So there we go. Ponyo is mad as toast. Race to Witch Mountain, you could see Dwayne Johnson in that, and so that worked a lot better. I mean, it's a fairly humdrum entry in the Witch Mountain saga, but it has some nice moments in it. Secret of Moonacre is a bit soppy and slightly mad as toast. Up is definitely a children's movie. Now, all you adults out there who are like, no, that is our movie, and a child could not hope to understand that first 50 minutes. Bugger off. It's a children's movie.
Yeah.
And, well, we're not going to discuss Transformers because I have nothing to say. Justin has nothing to say. We don't have to talk about Shia LaBeouf. And, of course, we know Ian didn't go and see it at the cinema. And I think we transformed enough in 2007. So there we go. But, yes, returning momentarily to G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. I only saw this at the cinema. I do own it on DVD, but some of these things, which is like, if I believed in such a thing, I would term it a guilty pleasure. Instead, I would rather say it is something I would put on and have a fun time, knowing that it was completely derivative tosh. But I have never put it on again, and I don't know why, because it was perfectly good fun. And the second movie was perfectly good fun as well. I mean, they're fun movies. The thing that most amazed me about G.I. Joe, the first one, is how much it rips off the original Star Wars trilogy without any shame on its face whatsoever. I mean, it is just basically Star Wars in G.I. Joe land, more or less. There's so much stuff in it. It's like, yeah, this is a bit like Star Wars, really. Yeah, this is still a bit like Star Wars.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I had to say, you know, G.I. Joe passed me by as a child. I know Leo was into it. I wasn't. So I had no real, like, nostalgia factor going to see this film. So I was just accepting what it was. And it was perfectly fine.
I don't think having a historical love of the G.I. Joe universe would really be of service to you in this new run, because Hasbro nakedly are just trying to sell new toys off the back of the old ones. And unlike the Transformers, I don't know quite what the deal is here, because maybe it's because the way that Michael Bay screwed up the design of Transformers stuff was ideal for Hasbro, because it meant they could write off all their old toys and make brand new toys which looked like the new stuff. And therefore, that was good because it made them money, because nobody wanted the old classic Transformers anymore. Now they wanted the shiny new ones for Christmas. And so that was much better. And I think G.I. Joe had a much rougher ride, in the sense that after this first one, which they were perfectly happy with, the studio decided to put the second one on ice because they didn't think it would make them much money. And then they released it when they had agreed to a Christmas release. They actually put it out in February, when it's no bloody use to anyone, because nobody's going to be buying any toys off the back of it. So Hasbro, in a very literal sense, picked up their toys and went home, and haven't been able to secure another distributor for G.I. Joe movies, which is, they have, I mean, the problem that they have is that a distributor will say, well, nobody's going to go and see this in cinema. Yeah, great, we'll make you like a 2-hour toy movie with Dwayne The Rock Johnson in it. But nobody's going to go and see it. So we're not going to make any money. Obviously, you have to pay us a lot of money to do that. And Hasbro don't want to pay them that much money. And that's why we haven't had G.I. Joe 3. Because quality, especially bearing in mind the fact the second G.I. Joe movie actually did pretty well after all this arguing. So, yeah, it's not quality that counts here. It's the fact that Hasbro want a big toy advert. And by golly, it works. But, yeah, being a fan of the old stuff really doesn't do you a service, because it just hurts when they ruin it.
Okay.
Same as Transformers, really. To bundle up the rest of the children's movies into one package, it varies between things that are just weird, e.g. Nine, Coraline, Astro Boy, Cirque du Freak, and things that are just disappointing, Aliens in the Attic, Dragon Ball Evolution, Inkheart. So is it a good year to be a child? I mean, there's certainly a lot on the buffet. It's just that none of it is...
When it's good, it's great, but there's not much of it.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit bleak, child-wise, at this part-time.
And in a similar vein, is it a good year to be a sci-fi fan? Because this is the year that brought us Avatar, District 9, Moon, Outlander, Pandora and Push, Splice, Star Trek, Surrogates, Terminator Salvation, The Box, The Road, Underworld, Rise of the Lycans, Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, and Watchmen.
What's Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 doing here?
Oh, sorry, I must have moved that wrong into the wrong list.
I mean, trains exist, Leo. They're real.
No, okay, I'm going to move that now into the list marked Better Explosions. That's later on. Spoilers, everybody. But yeah, so
I think it's looking overall, generally, it's looking pretty good for sci-fi.
Yeah,
I think.
I mean, once I'd added everything in, it doesn't look too bad. And I think this is more a case of there's some good stuff, there's some controversial stuff.
Yeah.
Avatar, I'm looking at you. And then there's some stinkers in there. So I'm real. Although controversial isn't just Avatar. There are people who absolutely love Push. And that's fine. I'm sure there are some people who are cult fans of The Box, but, you know, whatever.
Can I be controversial?
Yeah.
I enjoyed Avatar. I even enjoyed it in 3D. I consider it to be a genuine 3D experience. It was made to be 3D, and being 3D was supposed to be part of the experience, and I quite enjoyed the movie for what it was.
I think that, bearing in mind the fact that you're right, because I've never seen it in 3D, and in 2D, it's a bunch of rubbish.
I was actually disappointed with the 3D stuff. I was, it was talked about and hyped, and I actually went, I really don't like 3D stuff. And so, I went, well, it's designed for that, so I'll watch it. And I didn't get it. I don't know why. I just went, I'm not getting the benefit of this.
Don't get me wrong. I suppose the technology is quote unquote groundbreaking. And to be honest with you, the 3D is not the thing that lingers in my head, as it was part of the experience of watching it was the 3D. There is no original ideas here whatsoever. It's utterly derivative. Feed in all the elements you want into a computer and press generate script. Little green bar fills up, script pops out. I totally agree. It's full of schmaltzy ideas, and it's a very ancient idea about, you know, here comes the white hero to save the savages against the nasty white colonists, imperialists that have turned up. Unobtainium is a stupid name for a metal to be fighting over as well. But in terms of a derivative idea, I thought it was a relatively well-polished derivative idea. It seemed to be quite an exciting world. I can understand why some people really wanted to be sucked into this better fantasy world.
Yeah, the ecology of the world, I mean, obviously, you know, I admire all the work that went into it and the creature design. That's all fine. Now, you know, I will look at that, my artistic view, and go, wow, that's really, very pretty. For me, though, it wasn't enough. It was way too long for the story. I didn't think the story merited like an enormous film of this type. So I came out of it rather kind of my buttocks were sore and I was rather disappointed.
And let us not forget the influence of Sam Funsucker Worthington, who made this film. This is the thing. This is a film of battles that were won and wars that were lost. Sam Worthington wanted to be the next big sci-fi action dude and then found to his detriment that he sucks all the fun out of any film he's in and therefore no longer has a career.
To be fair, for most of the films, Sam Worthington is a blue furry and he's much more tolerable like that, I found.
Well, whatever. Just imagine if all the hype, well, not hype, but the actual statements of things that they expected. They expected Avatar to be on a par in cultural history with Terminator and Aliens and the other James Cameron stuff. Because they said, well, it worked for Titanic. I mean, that's got James Cameron's name attached to it and everyone expected it to, sink without trace. But did it? No. It's still a thing even today. Well, so I think they had good...
You're right. Avatar did quite well, as I recall. I didn't think it did poorly.
Yes, oh no, it did. They won that battle.
They won that battle. And to be fair, the problem with it is they've just taken too bloody long to get the sequels out. I appreciate James Cameron is trying to do quote-unquote groundbreaking visual effects here, and this is why it's taking so long, because he literally has to invent the cameras to do what he wants to do. And I think it's that gap that has diminished Avatar. I think if we'd had like Avatar 2 out by now, we might feel different about it.
I would disagree with that wholeheartedly on the grounds that you don't understand what I mean by battle and war. The battle was, will people rock up to the cinema? This, remember, 3D was something they did in kids' movies. People were already grumbling about having to pay extra money for glasses, particularly as everything that had come out up to that stage was kids' movies. So this was the first adult movie. So no, you were going to get something out of paying the extra money to watch this in 3D. And they won that battle. It was a big phenomenon when it was at the cinema. But the whole war is that then, does the film have a life afterwards? Because for God's sake, you know, Joss Whedon gets the job directing the Avengers in part because Firefly and Serenity, although both were unpopular enough to get cancelled and to bomb at the box office, the length, the long tail on those products is absolutely, I mean, they still have Firefly conventions today. The Firefly and Serenity are cultural icons. Yeah. Avatar, they made a big deal about the DVD release and nobody could be bothered. I don't know anyone who goes, I'm just going to stick Avatar on for a laugh.
It's one of the few things I count as a cinematic experience.
It's fine.
With most of the Marvel films, I've seen them on DVD, I'll be honest with you. But Avatar is like, no, it's the sort of thing I go see in the cinema, and I haven't bought it on DVD again since, but I remember seeing it and going, yes, that was, again, technically very good, technically very well polished, and yes, you know, turn off your higher thoughts and just let yourself go with the schmaltzy escapism.
Well, I think that, and that is exactly the thing. I think that you don't buy many DVDs, Ian. And I think when somebody is like a collector like me who goes, I want all the interesting cultural things, all of them. And I get to Avatar, I go, that is not an interesting cultural thing. Mm. And I move on and everybody tends to agree with me. This is the thing. I had a DVD clear out the other week. And do you know what survived? Independence Day. I'm not really that keen on Independence Day, but when it came to throwing it out, I was like, no, Independence Day is a thing. Avatar doesn't even get on the shelf to go in a DVD cull because I don't want to watch it ever again.
Mm. Oh, well, we'll see how we feel once more Avatars come out.
In terms of not necessarily like groundbreaking effects, but the thing that shook me up was District 9, like, in terms of, like, sci-fi, like, doing something generally different. And that was because it was doing something different with plot and tone and theme. And those things, I think, are more important to play around with than just technology. I remember being utterly blown away by District 9.
Yeah, District 9 is pretty weighty. It's weird. It's the one film, I don't own a copy of it, but I'm actually quite a big fan. And I love Sharlto Copley, but I didn't know I did when I went in because nobody knew who he was. But I love him. I think he's a great actor. But yeah, it's mental.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a lot of very refreshing elements to this film. It, you know, the guy, the lead is not a hero at all by any stretch of the imagination. And it's quite gritty and grim and nasty. And it feels like it's giving you some kind of social message as well. I'm not entirely sure if that translates. After I came out, I was like, well, there's a few problems in there. I think it's a bit weird that this goo is also their fuel and also transforms you into one of those creatures. That seems a bit overly complicated for what it is. But in terms of the ideas that are in play here, it's like, well, here is a higher form of science fiction I haven't seen for a very long time in cinema. And so I am giving this film props because I want to encourage this kind of behavior.
These things have had an effect, because we've also got Moon. Outlander is something, trying something different. Pandorum was trying something different, it has to be said. Push was trying something different. Blythe wasn't trying something different. Surrogates was trying to be an interesting idea. It was really trying. Bless It, it was really trying. It still came last, but hey, whatever. The Box was definitely trying something different, but then it's Kelly. So a lot of the sci-fi that got released was all trying. Ooh, yeah. And The Road. Did anyone actually ever see The Road?
Yeah. Nope. Oh god, yeah, I've seen
it. Justin's seen it.
Oh dear.
And how was that?
Well, you know, all the fun you could expect from, you know, post-apocalyptic kind of doom and gloom.
Well, all the fun you can expect from a version of Mad Max which takes place at night with Viggo Mortensen, and instead of having a hot rod, he has a shopping trolley, as I understand it.
It's pretty bleak. It's pretty bleak, that's all I'm saying. I was playing a lot of a certain computer game at the time which was dealing with similar
Fallout
with similar themes, and I was having more fun there because there was giant robots and monsters and mutants to shoot at, so this was like that devoid of all of the fun. So it was like, yeah, great, okay, that's great. If I really want to think about post-apocalyptic world, then it probably would be like this, deeply depressing, and it's like, great, there's a couple of hours of my life devoted to that.
If you wanted a post-apocalyptic world that was filled with robots and monsters and things to shoot at, surely Terminator Salvation was your go-to. Terminator Salvation, a film so bad, it was sent back through time to terminate the Terminator franchise, and it nearly succeeded.
You know me, guys. You know me, guys. I'm a huge Terminator fan.
Is Sam Worthington in this as well?
Yes, he is.
Let's deal with him. Well, he's been dealt with, so that's good. Yeah.
You know me, I am a huge Terminator fan. I've seen all versions of Terminator. Apart from this one, I have never seen Terminator Salvation. I was warned off it rather strongly, and I had a bad vibe about it anyway. Every time I say, oh, I haven't seen that film, everyone says, don't bother. So I'm just going to skip it and go straight to Genesis and get disappointed by that instead.
Yeah, you see, how the tables will have turned for while you go and see Terminator Genesis and then come out and say, don't bother going to see that. Everyone else will be going, yeah, we saw it coming because we went to see Salvation, because the audience are always one movie behind. So yes, having experienced Salvation, this is one of the big things I think that is standing in Genesis's way, is that generally the audiences are remembering Salvation, and before that they're remembering Terminator 3, and then they're thinking Terminator 2, was that like 25 years ago? Blimey, it was. Well, they haven't made a decent Terminator movie in 25 years. Why should they start now? And that'll be the end of that, really. I mean, just to run through the others, Moon is two Sam Rockwells arguing with one another, while Kevin Spacey is Hal in the background. Very much worth seeing, if you haven't done so, just to see what one actor can do by himself for an hour and a half stranded on the moon. Outlander, we've already discussed elsewhere. Pandorum, I kind of wanted to watch this again because I wondered if I was unfair. I wondered if it was one of those things where I was expecting one thing and I got another, and that's what made me disappointed. Push is like a 90s superhero movie, like where they're embarrassed about there being superheroes in it. So they keep trying to push up dark, edgy material at the expense of fun. And that's I think that, but there are people who really like that movie. Splice is the most dunderheaded piece of science fiction horror I think I've ever seen, which is a surprise because it comes from the man who brought you those little know-nothing movies like Cube and Cypher. And it's like, really? So he made Cube and Cypher, and then he read the script for this and thought, oh, that's jolly good. I'll make this as a film. Instead of, I made Cube and Cypher. This is so far beneath me, it's not even true. Weird. He must have been having a funny, maybe there's something, mushrooms or something. Maybe he smelt fudge when there was no fudge. Yeah, so there's that. Surrogates is Bruce Willis again trying to do, the thing about Bruce Willis is he's very game. Sometimes he gets behind a project and he really pushes it, even though he really shouldn't bother. Trying to inspire so many people with these terrible projects that just are so boring and tedious and mediocre can cause hair loss, I understand.
I really had a problem with Surrogates. It's just I didn't believe the world, right? I've got a pretty good tolerance of, I will go along with whatever if it's reasonably coherent, whatever fantasy we see up on the screen. But I did not buy the world of Surrogates at all. So it was never going to start off well, kind of going, really? This is what people are like, really, seriously? Like in 30 years time, we'll all be living in our rooms and living out our work, just going out looking. No, this is not going to happen. And also no one can afford this stuff. It's crazy. So all it was already losing on me. And then I just had to sit through going, yep, that was that.
Yeah. And then we've got, obviously, Underworld Rise of the Lycans, we'll just mention past. I'm sure I've probably talked about it before. It's Michael Sheen in leather trousers doing a prequel that isn't really a prequel, but really just the first film in the trilogy made after the other two for some bizarre reason. I mean, recently there was something that I saw that was a prequel. I thought, yeah, that's a prequel where it fills something in that's very important. Whereas this is the first film. You just happen to have made it third for some reason. But it's a good film. I enjoyed it. I still enjoy it. I own a copy. I like Underworld Rise of the Lycans. Yeah. So yeah. Sue me. I would say, has anybody else seen The Box apart from me?
I haven't actually seen it, no.
Like, this is obviously, this is from the man who bought you Donnie Darko. That, I mean, that's all I really need to say. I mean, when it says film CV is Donnie Darko, Southland Tales, and about, I kind of imagine that the executive producers, the studio heads who go to Richard Kelly like, now Richard, Donnie Darko worked. You were lucky. We have to accept you were lucky. He's like, yeah, I accept I was lucky, but we can't do that again. We know that you can direct a film because you brought Donnie Darko in and it made money. But we're about to give you some money. And what are you not going to do with that money, Richard? Make some completely incomprehensible piece of bizarre surrealism that isn't really for a mass market audience, but has loads of wacky special effects in it? Good. So if we give you the money, that's not what you're going to do, right? No. All right, then. Here's the money. Off I go to make something that nobody will understand, but that has loads of flashy special effects in it, and that people are like, was that genius or just rubbish? I'm not sure. Southland Tales kind of is just on the rubbish end, although I do remember there are some bizarre moments in that I might like to see again. The Box is the ultimate end of this. It manages to hold it together for quite a while, but then there's that point, much the same as Donnie Darko. I think this is a hallmark of Richard Kelly stuff. Southland Tales fails because you never understand what's going on in Southland Tales, whereas Donnie Darko and The Box both share this thing where you kind of think you're following it for quite a long time, and then there comes a moment, and from that moment on the entire thing is just like, what the hell am I watching? And The Box is like Donnie Darko turned up to 11. When it starts to go bonkers, it doesn't hold back. It's like someone slipped LSD into David Lynch's LSD and then let him read the second half of the script. It is absolutely crazy. Okay. Is it science fiction? Is it fantasy? Is it? We don't know. Yeah, I'd love to watch it again.
Okay. And it's it. We got the Star Trek reboot.
Yes, I've left Star Trek and Watchmen till last.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much to say about Star Trek, ironically. I think it's just like, yeah, that was, well, Ian is our resident Star Trek fan. Ian, Star Trek.
I have very complicated emotions about the reboots of Star Trek. Look, the situation we were in as Star Trek fans was an interesting one. Voyager was felt to be a kind of a mixed bag, and at the time everyone felt Enterprise was pretty, pretty awful, and these days there's just some people who thinks it got alright towards the end, and that's pretty much as good. But the general feeling was, We want Star Trek to die. The fans wanted the series to go off into the desert for a while and have a rethink about what it wanted to be. And it wanted to come back and try and be a popular piece of entertainment again. So in many ways, this is what we wanted. And I think it was a very clever mechanism they used to reboot by actually incorporating the reboot into canon. So it's like it's an in-canon reboot. It wasn't just like, back to the start, everybody. So that was very kind of them to do that. They didn't have to do that. And having Nimoy on board helped soothe everything. And it's a good cast and a nice director and a jolly action film. But it's not Star Trek, I'm sorry to say. I feel this way in the shadow of Star Trek Into Darkness. Overall, it's like, well, I'm glad it's back and people are watching it and glad people like Star Trek, but it's just not Star Trek, because Star Trek is fundamentally an episodic television series. It's my conclusion. People are very excited about this potential Doctor Who film we're definitely going to have at some point in the future, because BBC Enterprise are pushing for it. And it's like, it's going to be terrible. Why do people want a Doctor Who movie? It's going to be awful. Doctor Who is not a film. It is a TV series. It comes in lots of episodes bundled together. It's a selection box. Same with Star Trek. Star Trek is, I hate to say, well, I'm going to sound, you may disagree with me, is an intelligent, a popular science fiction series that pushes ideas, whereas films should be about these are good guys, these are broadly speaking bad guys, this is the thing at stake, they have a battle, woo, logic, end. So overall, I'm glad people are enjoying. Yes, I'm glad the people are enjoying, but for me, no, I'm afraid I'm still stuck in the 80s wearing a red uniform, and it's where my heart belongs.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. But I would say this in terms of films, Star Trek films, there's a lot of bad Star Trek films.
Mm.
And
there still
and,
are.
I'm just saying that, so because we don't have a series, we've got the films. And I think that for me, who's not a fan particularly of the films, let's say, with some notable exceptions, but most of the time I'm not enamoured by them. I thought Star Trek did a great job because really it's appealing to Star Wars fans, which is something I always felt it needed. With Star Trek films, they always felt like, as a TV series, they work great. It works perfectly fine, as you say, you know, and that's obviously what it's designed for. The moment you put that on a big screen, you feel like there should be more action. It shouldn't just be the kind of the same format. And they always struggled with that. So well, Star Trek reboot pretty much went, right, this is going to be kick-ass. It's going to be the pacing. It's going to have the drama that you would expect from something like the Star Trek franchise, Star Wars franchise. And so for me, that was exciting. I absolutely love the reboot.
All well and good, but that's not Star Trek. I mean, it should be about solving a problem in some form or other. You can still have explosions around it and exciting set pieces, but there isn't really. There's also quite a few sort of problems with the film. I don't want to get into nitpicky about it, but the villain makes no sense. His motivations make no sense. The Federation failed to save my planet, so now I'm going to blow up all their planets. So that seems a bit of an odd grudge. You travel back in time. Why don't you try saving your planet? Go back to Romulus and say, hey, guess what? Your sun's going to explode in 80 years. Do you want to do something about that? No, no, no. I'm going to blow up Vulcan. The destruction of Vulcan was a genuine gut punch I wasn't expecting. And
oh, no, exactly. But I think that, for me, right, it was a solution to a problem that Star Trek has been having for years, in that it has so much history behind it that becomes progressively hard
to do stuff. And so,
in terms of films, you know, they kind of took that mantle and have really struggled with it. And I thought I can totally get your point as a Star Trek fan. I totally get that. But for someone who's not particularly a Trekkie, I thought to have a way of freeing yourself from that and starting something generally new was a very brave and a smart choice. So that the sky's the limit. Now we can go from the, and you know, I was hoping that there'd be a TV series, right? That would be a new thing. That's what I was hoping for. It hasn't, obviously it's not the direction they're really going. But I thought, wow, what an opportunity. You're pressing the big reset button. And now we can have something totally new and fresh. And I want to see more of that. And unfortunately, they did not follow that up with a sequel in the same way, which is
just laden with continuity.
So that was a shame, and I was maybe at this stage when I saw it, thought, oh, the possibilities. This is going to be great. We're going to have a TV, not necessarily those actors, but we're going to have a, like, maybe a TV series set in this alternate thing and something different. And I don't know, I got very excited about it, but it hasn't manifested, and clearly they're just going along with the films, and it's not as exciting now. But I still think, for me, it was possibly one of the most exciting things that happened to Star Trek. You know, yeah, but then that's from someone who's not generally a fan. So I can, yeah. I appreciate, to sort of maybe
try and bring these two perspectives together. I think that you're right, Justin, in that it's an exciting thing to happen to the franchise in the way when it happened in 2009. You know, you came out and you know, Sue's comment was, well, that's the first Star Trek movie I've ever seen, which made me give a shit about Star Trek. So good. Well done. Marvelous. And in fact, with the benefit of hindsight, when you move on and then there's Into Darkness and you're just like, I mean, Into Darkness is a chore. It really is. It's not something you go, oh, good, I'll watch that again. I've watched Star Trek, the first Star Trek reboot, 3 times. Good, it's good fun every time. And but the point is, it is like, it's a starting point. It's like, yeah, this is what. And when you say, oh, well, you know, maybe they have a TV series, not with those actors. Let's look at who those actors are. Chris Pine. Okay. Zachary Quinto, he does a lot of television. Zoe Saldana, she's not really busting the box office on a regular basis. Simon Pegg, he's never done television. Oh, no, wait, he's done loads of television and he's British and cheap. And was it Carl Urban? Oh, he would never do a television series except for that one about him being a cop with a robot partner. Yeah, okay. So he did, in fact, do a television series after this. So basically, all of your, and John Cho, who is Harold Kumar, they finished. So he's been in many other television series indeed as well. So really, you have a cast of television actors and a bunch of sets you built for a multi-million dollar movie, which made its money back. Hey, here's a crazy idea. Why don't we all give them television contracts and make a Star Trek series? Oh, who could we get to help us set that up? I mean, who died? J.J. Abrams. Oh, he's never done a television series. Oh, wait. So, you see, they had all the ingredients in place. I mean, really, there was no barrier. And all, what they chose to do instead is piss a bunch of money up the wall on a sort of a secret remake of The Wrath of Khan with Humbudding Wimbersquatch. So, really?
You know, having someone who loves Wrath of Khan, you know, I felt personally kind of violated on that one. And I'm sure Ian probably, I know we're not really going to talk about that, but I'm sure Ian wasn't entirely happy by that either.
With the original Star Trek, yes, you're right, it was all the potential of where we were going to go with this. Not only is Into Darkness a squandering of that potential, it took them a bloody long time to get it out. Remember, Star Trek was actually a film that was held back. It was ready for the previous year and they let it sit and wait. And then there was a long gap before Into Darkness came out, and now we're going. It's amazing that we in this year 2015, we've only had one more Star Trek film since then. They're hardly pumping these things out, are they? And it's not like these actors are overly busy, so they really haven't been pushing the fund. If they knocked out like 3, or maybe even 4, which is potentially once every other year would have been fine. Maybe we'd have a body of work now, and I might feel totally different about all this, but it's a very kind of once in a blue moon occasion, and it only takes one sucky film for this to stall again. I'm sorry to say, Star Trek is a TV series, and now because we have this reboot, you've essentially landlocked the TV series. The TV series has nowhere to go because it can't step on the film's toes. All the ideas about a Star Trek series is, believe it or not, that we've been knocked around those last few years in development hell, a kind of set in a sort of back in the next gen universe in a timeline that technically doesn't exist. Maybe now, not maybe. I don't know. It's confusing. Oh, it just in the end, I just feel like, oh, this is
The next step from Star Trek was not Into Darkness. The next step from Star Trek was a television series of the quality of Fringe. Set in the Star Trek universe.
Good news, everyone. We now have, working on the script, we have the fanboy, Simon Pegg, writing it. And he says he's been asked to take the Trek out of Star Trek, which fills me with hope and enthusiasm for the third film.
Wow. I'm detecting some sarcasm.
So not a great time to be a Trekkie, I suppose.
Was it ever a good time to be an Alan Moore fan? Watchmen came out this year. Yeah. Let us move on. Watchmen is very much, it occurs to me now that what does Watchmen have in common with Harry Potter? Well, the film kind of happens and there it is.
I really enjoyed Watchmen. Now, with one exception, I would say one part of it, the kind of sex scene I didn't like at the time. I remember watching it with, you know, a bunch of us went off to see it, and I was like squirming in the cinema going, "Ah, it's uncomfortable. This is horrible." With that part of it, like, I could remove that. I love it. Watchmen for me, the graphic novel was like groundbreaking for me, right? That was the point where my assessment of what a comic is, or what a comic could be, changed fundamentally. I read that and I'm like, oh my God, this has changed. I'm going to look at things in a whole new light. I'm going to, you know, look into kind of darker, grittier stuff. It just blew my mind. And I read it a lot and I knew it intimately. And so I've been wanting to someone to do a film, but you know, you secretly kind of fear when you've got something cherished that someone's going to remake is going to be bloody awful and totally, you know, totally changed beyond all recognition. But it's made by a fanboy and it is like, it is close. It is bloody close to the vision that I remember. You know, just the look of it, the tone was spot on. The changes they made were really smart changes for like cinematic audiences now. I'm very, very pleased generally, you know, with The Watchmen. I thought the beginning was amazing. Like that got me. The opening credits, I sat there going, oh, this is going to be good. I mean, just stunning. Say, with kind of like one thing that I have a serious issue with, I love it. I think it's, it is like done what it's done. I think there's still talk about doing like prequels with the characters that might happen. I don't, who knows?
They've done comic books. They haven't done a film.
It is intentionally kind of meant to be a standalone thing. Because, you know, it's like we set all this up and then, you know, we break it all. You know, that's the thing. I love it. I think it's like stunning, like adaptation of something. It got it right for me. Where there are people who haven't read it, what they feel about it, I don't know.
Well, hello. Yes, I hadn't read Watchmen. I still haven't read Watchmen, but I'm now a lot more familiar with it. I watched it and thought, this will make a really good comic book. I wasn't too sure about it being a film. I think it'll make a great HBO 10-part series. In the comic book series, Dr. Manhattan definitely has genitals on display. In the Watchmen film, Dr. Manhattan has a wang on display. It's like, well, it's quite well endowed. You've got him there. Before it was just kind of like, you know, Statue of David kind of genitals. But my goodness me, this man could control his own body. Why not? I'd give myself a large penis. Who wouldn't?
Well, there we go. So, balls then. But anyway, yeah. So,
if you wanted to see a big blue dick on screen, then it wouldn't be Avatar you'd be immediately thinking of. But anyway, that's...
I think that my thing is, to a certain extent, it's caught in amber. It's a thing that was done. And I think this is a time when people are learning that, you know, this is where you have a transition in CGI from, oh, that's a bit ropey, to now we can pretty much pull off everything as long as we do it the right way. And then you discover, but now we can do this incredibly complicated thing and make it so perfect. But it sort of becomes a bit sterile for that. And that's what I feel there's no emotional undercurrent.
I didn't get sexiness from it at all. It just felt like, even without the sex scene, it just felt
the sex scene
is more
like sexy. It's uncomfortable and horrible.
Well, all the sexuality in the film is pretty horrible and uncomfortable. Everywhere throughout.
And it's not, when you read it, it's not like sexy in that way.
I agree with you, it probably isn't. It's actually when you see it as a film in one body of work. The rape victim having a bit of a thing for the man who nearly raped her was a bit off-putting, to be honest with you.
You know, the whole point of the comic is to strip away all that fetishism of superheroes and that. That's the whole point of it. So it does that, it does leave you rather cold and stuff, because the comic does, it's like, let's take our archetypes, and here's what, we'll strip them away bare and see what, you know. It's just doing what the novel does.
I think that the thing is that it's almost like the polar opposite of the previous year's Punisher Warzone, now I come to think about it. Because watching that again, I was like, wow, this is kind of brutal. Because they are equitable, because Watchmen has some sequences where people go at each other with screwdrivers and drills and saws and all sorts of stuff. And whereas when you walk away from Punisher Warzone, you're like, wow, that was a bit crazy. When you walk away from Watchmen, you go, oh, that kind of happened. And I think that's possibly where my problem lies. You should feel at some point, oh, I'm disgusted by this, or I'm outraged by that. Or, and you're not, really. You just go, there it is. It happened. But was it a good year to be a horror fan in 2009? That is another question. There was certainly a lot of horror on offer. Those being Drag Me to Hell, Friday the 13th remake, Halloween 2, remake of Halloween 2, crazy. Jennifer's Body, My Bloody Valentine 3D, which is a remake of My Bloody Valentine. Orphan, Saw, six of them, gosh. The Final Destination, The Fourth Kind, which isn't a sequel, even though it has a four in it, never mind. Last House on the Left, another remake. The Unborn, not a remake, probably will never be remade. And Zombieland. So it's like a bit of a shit sandwich, really. We've got the nice pieces of bread, Drag Me to Hell and Zombieland, on the top and the bottom, and in between, a whole lot of rubbish, really. I mean, Jennifer's Body was supposed to be good, and some people really liked it, but trust me, it wasn't. And Saw 6 is where, you know, let's not forget that the one after Saw 6 is like, no, we're finishing this now, because it kind of got to that point where it was like, really, they'd run out of ideas halfway through Saw 5 completely. I believe this is the one with Peter Outerbridge in it, Saw 6. It's so just, yeah, let's get through this. And then Saw 7 comes along and goes, yep, we are now going to get through this and finish it. And it makes a nice little sort of bloody punctuation mark on the end of the franchise. Saw 6 is definitely the worst Saw movie. So even the things that are technically new franchises, but look at the sheer volume of remakes and sequels.
Oh yeah,
and remakes.
They're really into their stride with the reboot of the horror franchise, aren't they? And yeah, I don't even remember there being a Friday the 13th reboot. That passed me by.
Friday the 13th is great because it's offensive to Friday the 13th fans, because of course the Friday the 13th, the original movie, the killer is famously not Jason. Spoilers, right. Everybody, yeah. For that. What is it? A 35-year-old movie. Whereas in Friday the 13th, the reboot, oh, screw it. No, he's a zombie in a hockey mask with a machete. He doesn't get the hockey mask till like the fourth movie in the original run. It's just a complete, like, oh, it's so ridiculously horrible and terrible for all the wrong reasons. And then the fact that you've got Halloween 2, which is a remake of a sequel to Halloween, is just like stupid. I just want to make a special mention in the turkey vault for Orphan, whose strap line was, you'll never guess her secret. Right. It's like, well, you'll never guess her secret if you don't think along the lines of, it's a midget pretending to be a child. Because if you thought that as you were walking in, it would be as a joke. And then when they're like, no, you're really seriously trying to sell us this, it's a midget pretending to be a child. And it's like,
it's Jimmy Cranky gone wrong. It's you know.
So basically, yeah, you've got Drag Me to Hell and Zombieland. And after that, you've got a whole heap of just. Every time they try and do something new, it's awful. And every time they try and do something old, it's offensive to fans of the original. And it's awful. So I think we can probably conclude of this that it was not a good year to be a horror fan. Zombieland, I may have remarked on this before, is a movie that gets better the more times you watch it, which is very strange. There aren't many movies like this, but every time you stick on Zombieland, or at least I find, I have a good time. And I actually have, it kind of magnifies, as long as you, obviously, I don't think you could watch it like three times on the trot and be, by the time you've got to the end of the third one, you'd be like, yes, I've seen it. But if you just wait a decent amount of time, put it on, you actually remember the good time you had watching it last time. And that makes this time even better, because it adds a little misty-eyed moment of nostalgia. Oh, I remember last time I watched this. It was just as good. Oh, it's so funny. And it grows, and it's like a zombie apocalypse, really, and it keeps coming. And it, you know, there's lots of it, and you can't stop. I'm going to stop this analogy now.
I'm just not a horror fan in general. So there's not something to tempt me out to go see films. But I have seen Final Destination, and for me, it's kind of an example of why I'm just not a horror fan. Because I don't actually enjoy seeing pretty ordinary people slowly dying horribly. It's like watching an episode of Casualty where people don't survive to the hospital scenes.
The Final Destination is, this is like Fast and Furious. I think you may have seen Final Destination and not seen The Final Destination, which is the last movie in that franchise.
Do they kill death at the end or something?
I've got no idea what happens.
But it's not the last one, is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh, but they're Final Fantasy V. Isn't that after that?
What you're looking at is the subtitle. It's called The Final Destination, but they also called it Final Destination 5 just to make it plain that it was the last series.
Right.
So yeah, so that was this is the last, you know, The Final Destination. Oh yeah, God. It's like if they called all the films in the Saw movie, yeah, like that. Saw, Saws, A Saw, At.
I'm a little sore.
Yeah. Zombieland obviously nearly ended up in the comedy category because it is. Is it more comedy or more horror movie? I'd probably err on the side of comedy. And of course, it's got you've got Woody Harrelson, you've got Emma Stone, the cast is incredible.
It's a kind of a smart comedy as well. It's not kind of just goofy, like playing for laugh. It's kind of a smart genre savvy. Kind of comedy, isn't it?
It gets away with ridiculous things like, that was nearly Zombie Kill of the Day. Unfortunately, today Tallahassee lost out to, and it cuts to like one of those like Family Guy style inserts of like a woman running away and then someone drops a piano on a zombie. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, it's just got those little touches. A simultaneously nostalgia inducing, hilarious and tragic cameo from Bill Murray.
Yes.
So yes, absolutely amazing. Just words cannot impress how much this is one of the best zombie movies ever. And in fact, I might actually shut my gob now, so that I've got something to say at another time, maybe about that movie. But it was in a good year in 2009 for the fan of literary adaptations. Well, I'm taking literary in a broad sense here as adaptations of books, because we had the man who brought us The Lord of the Rings and was still to bring us The Hobbit, bringing us The Lovely Bones. We had The Men Who Stare at Goats. We had The Time Traveler's Wife, and we had New Moon, to which I would probably conclude in that little bundle. No, it was not a good year for fans of literary adaptations, because with the exception of The Men Who Stare at Goats, which was all right to watch once, the others are all uniformly terrible. The Lovely Bones in particular is takes the crown as the worst Peter Jackson movie he has ever made. And he didn't even want to make it. He made it because someone else dropped out. He was like the supply teacher director of this movie, which is just awful. So yeah, and we don't even need to talk about New Moon. And The Time Traveler's Wife is only there because it has time travel in it. But to be fair, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, like you usually get angry about a time travel movie, or you nitpick that there's some kind of time traveling inconsistency in the plot logic. You know, Back to the Future, I'm looking at you. Yeah. In this one, it's all about I suppose it is interesting in a way to have a movie where it's like, yeah, time travel doesn't cause paradoxes or anything, but it does cause people some emotional heartache and some excuses for wistful staring and piano music. It's like, what? I think that the fundamental defying of the space-time continuum would have more effects than feeling a bit mopey. He doesn't understand how I feel, but that's because he's just dropped in from 3 weeks ago, and so he hasn't lived the intervening period. Or he's just popped in from the future, so to him this is all in the past. Oh, how shall I yearn? What?
I've seen Lovely Bones. I've seen The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Oh, well, nobody's seen New Moon. Table, no, we don't do that stuff. I've seen the top three, and yeah, Men Who Stare at Goats is okay.
I thought Lovely Bones was okay. I didn't think it was awful.
It was really. Were you on some kind of medication? Because really, I mean, it's like. I was killed by Stanley Tucci and left in a basement, and then I got to mope around a bit. And then there was a bit which is a bit like I was trapped in a lava lamp or something, and then it was all over, and we learnt something existential.
I think I liked the ending particularly, but I just, I don't know, I think it was all quite, I don't know, I didn't have a huge problem with it, it was fine. If you're going to talk about the worst Peter Jackson film, there was things that offended me a lot more than that.
Like what?
Like Hobbit Part 3. It just washed over me. It's not something I feel I need to watch again. It was just what it is. So I just went, let's go.
The Hobbit Part 3 is just pointless, though. It's not. I mean, I actually think I found The Lovely Bones borderline offensive.
Oh, okay, so that's fine. All right. It didn't really affect me on whether I was like, okay, that was that.
Inappropriate. Well, as it washed over you, I think possibly my problem and Sue's problem as well was when we thought about what was happening a little bit much, and therefore it became, oh, this is actually quite offensive. Let's walk away. So yeah, that's your literary adaptation. So we only four movies and all of them were a bit rubbish. So, maybe you feel a bit depressed after that. So you want to laugh. Now it has come to my attention that comedies are getting a bit of a rough ride at the moment. Well, this is the year, I think, that created our current position where they try and get you with one or two big comedies instead of peppering the year with comic treats. So we get 17 again, Fanboys, I Love You Man, Land of the Lost, Lesbian Vampire Killers, The Hangover, The Haunting in Connecticut has managed to get out of the horror section. Well, The Haunting in Connecticut is just in part of that shit sandwich, so I'll just move that back up there. And we didn't even need to talk about it because it's that bad. Sorry, The Invention of Lying is the other one.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that we're looking at here is The Hangover, which of course set this precedent for the massive summer comedy kind of thing, because it absolutely broke the bank and everybody was like, wow, it's fantastic. The unintended consequence of The Hangover is that now you get these years where there's like five comedies all year. Like really? I've picked up some of the major comedies and Fanboys, but some years you get a lot of comedy, this year not so much. And of the others, 17 again is inoffensive. Fanboys is forgettable. I Love You Man is hilarious, but didn't do very well at the time because it's kind of a weird concept, or at least it was at the time. Land of the Lost apparently really pissed off people who like Land of the Lost. I didn't mind it because it was silly enough to not annoy me.
It's okay, but it's not.
Yeah. Lesbian Vampire Killers, I haven't seen because apparently it's so dreadful.
It's not great. It's not great.
And The Invention of Lying is where Ricky Gervais finally managed to make a dint in the US with a fairly forgettable kind of Twilight Zone thing. It has some great moments in it, but overall it kind of drags on a bit. So, and then The Hangover killed everything and made loads of money. So there we go.
I've heard of The Hangover.
Yeah, it's definitely worth watching.
No, I actually would say that if you were going to watch one movie off that list, I Love You Man is the one to watch.
Yeah, I Love You Man is good. Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Wasn't Lesbian Vampire Killers a joke in Red Dwarf at one point? The sort of film Lister would watch. That seems to be.
I guess so.
It's it's like the heart is there. It's just not good enough. That's the problem. It's just, no, you're expecting it to be better than it is. That's the problem.
I'm not sure that I would with a name like Lesbian Vampire Killers due to the fact
But you think that what you think is that the makers have kind of got their tongue in cheek and they're kind of chosen that for a reason. And
I think is that they're trying too hard to give the impression you're just talking about. And that's why I'm walking away.
Oh, that's right. Red Dwarf, it was Revenge of the Surfboarding Killer Bikini Vampire Girls. I just kind of think the title just sums that feeling up.
And that, well, no, you see, that shows you exactly the point. If they'd have actually called it Revenge of the Surfer, blah, 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 all of that, that would have been like, okay, they might have a point here.
I think fundamentally the problem is that the two main characters and the two actors just aren't great film actors. They're perfectly fine in Gavin and Stacey, and some would say, you know, kind of they're great in that. You put them on a big screen, they can't really fill it, and that's always going to be a problem, really. So, yeah, it doesn't really work.
So I will just spare a moment to tell people who haven't seen I Love You Man to go and see it. And the reason why is because this is the world's only, I think, deeply important bromance comedy, on the ground that at the beginning of the film, Paul Rudd plays a character who proposes to his girlfriend, who says yes. So he's got a perfectly fine love life. They establish this right up the front. He had no problem getting and keeping a long-term girlfriend he is now going to marry and make his wife. At which point she mentions the fact that, because, you know, when you get married, you're supposed to have a stag do. She kind of says, well, you should have a stag do. But she says, oh, but you haven't really got any friends, have you? He's like, I've got friends. And then it becomes blatantly apparent that although he's fine in his family, I mean, they even go to the length of giving him a gay brother who gets on with his dad better than he does, that he basically is fundamentally unable to relate to other men. He just can't do it. So then he meets Jason Segel, not literally the actor. The actor is playing the character. He's an estate agent, and this guy turns up to a house viewing. And this guy's like the Uber dude. He lives in a garage with his drum set, and like he basically lives in a man cave that's a garage, this guy. And he's at the house viewing, not because he wants to buy the house, but he's learned it's a great place to surf the buffet. Then he knows exactly how to secretly fart so it doesn't offend anyone, but it's still kind of funny. I mean, this guy is like the dude, you know, he is a man through and through. And so Paul Rudd befriends this man. I mean, the thing is, what it teaches you is that a man who is that manly, who's that much of a bloke, will relate to even a man who just isn't blokey at all, just can't, because he's that blokey, that's kind of the brotherhood of man stuff. And this guy is totally irresponsible, and that's where the humor comes from. On the one hand, you have Paul Rudd completely, the fantastic moment where they go out on their first man date, where they go to have fish tacos at a bar and drink beer and talk about man stuff. And then at the end of the evening, instead of their last kiss, they have to say goodbye to each other with some hand gestures and a nickname. And Paul Rudd goes, "So I'll hit you up again, Joban." And Jason Scales like, "Did you just say Joban?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't do that again." "All right then, fine. I'll call you." "Okay then, cool." And that's it. And it's just, it just does every trope of a romantic comedy and all the moments, but it does it in a way where it's two guys trying to male bond. You know, one guy just can't and the other guy just does it effortlessly. That's kind of funny. And yeah, it's a great movie for that point, because it takes a point, it sticks to it, and you don't need another one. You don't need "I Love You Man" again, or "I Love You Man T-O-O," as they would have done in the 80s. Mm. It's this fine standalone moment. But we're going to finish off 2009 now with a look at the explosions of 2009, and it was a year of very mixed explosions. I haven't called them bad explosions and good explosions. I've called them bad explosions and better explosions. Some of them are good, but some of them aren't. In the bad explosions category, we have 2012 Angels and Demons, which doesn't even it does have an explosion.
One explosion at the end.
Yeah. Armored, Blood the Last Vampire, Fast and Furious, the nadir of that world-beating franchise. Knowing, which I suppose should be in sci-fi in a way, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And X-Men Origins Wolverine. Oh, what a tale of woe that is. I mean, for God's sake. I mean, I have a Knowing story. Knowing is without a doubt,
oh my God,
the most offensive movie on a spiritual level to atheists, to Christians, to any given spiritual sect of any sort. It's just offensive. And the fact that they even thought that that was okay in any way. I mean, it's offensive to human beings. If you're not a human being, you probably think it was a really crappy thriller. If you are human and you walk out and you're not just like, "That was poo and makes me hurt in my heart," then you're not human.
No. I think you can like ignore that. If you walk out 15 minutes early, you know, you might just be disappointed. So maybe that's what people should do, really. They must see this film, which I don't encourage.
No, but the point is, if you walk out 15 minutes early, you're just like, that was rubbish. Yeah. I think in order to get the thing out of it that the movie has to deliver to the universe, what you have to do is watch it right through to the end. And I remember I was in the cinema, my jaw actually dropped. I was thinking, they're not really doing this, are they? This is good grief. And that's the point. That's roller coaster of the bad kind. But otherwise all you get is meh.
At least the fact that it exists in its entirety means that whoever was responsible for that in terms of writing and whatever hopefully goes away and never does anything else.
I'm not even going to check that just on the basis that it might depress me if I learned the answer. Ian, do you even know about this film?
Knowing. I saw a trailer for it, and I think I avoided it, knowing it would only make me angry. You could say.
Yeah. What you've got in your head there is an idea of how angry it would make you. That is nothing compared to the incandescent fury that you would feel just in the last couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Be like, holy crap.
Is it a very smutsy, condescending answer or something?
No. Quite exactly the opposite.
No.
Right. I may as well. Let's go for it. Spoilers, everyone, for this movie that nobody should ever watch under any circumstances. Basically, you get this whole thing. What happens when the numbers run out? Now, obviously, the first thing, yeah, so there's a thing they find in a time capsule that has all this writing all over it. This crazy kid did when she was like 12 or something, and it has numbers on it. And Nicolas Cage takes it home and finds that the numbers relate to dates and coordinates where disasters happen and there's great loss of life. And then the numbers stop. Now, of course, one answer to what happened when the numbers run out is like, well, you should give her a new piece of paper, maybe. That is one answer.
Oh, this is annoying.
There's the answer that they want to get, that you obviously are supposed to. This is the strange thing, because obviously you're supposed to say, well, of course, when the numbers run out, the world ends. And then you're like, yes, but obviously it's a twist movie, so there's going to be some kind of.
No,
there is no twist. The world ends when the numbers run out, because the whole thing is set up by, I'm not saying, right, it was aliens, but it was aliens. They are broadcasting to the minds of various young people on the face of the planet, sort of a codex to these disasters, to tell you, hey, you realize what's going to happen. There's going to be a big solar flare and then the entire world's going to end. But it's all right, because the aliens come along and they pick up the children that they've identified with this crazy sort of psychic stuff. And they kind of do a sort of a Pied Piper Hammond thing, and they take them away in their alien spaceships, leaving everybody else to die. And at the end of the film, a huge cleansing fire comes from the sun and wipes the earth clean until it is just a lifeless hunk of rock, which they do with lots. I mean, it's like a disaster movie that lasts 5 minutes. It's kind of like 2012 if 2012 didn't take 2.5 hours. Basically, it's 5 minutes. It's like the microwave version of 2012. You just pierce the lid a bit, put it in for five minutes, and it goes ping. And it's kind of like the end of the film is grabbing you by the scruff of the neck and going, atheists with your aliens, this is what you want, isn't it? This is what you want. And then it kind of slaps you in the face and goes, hey, Christians, this is that apocalypse you keep going on about. And then it slaps you in the face and goes, Jehovah's Witnesses. It just takes every religion and goes, yeah, this is the end of the world. This is what you're asking for, isn't it? You know, when you go with that thing saying the end is nigh, this is what you're asking for. Are you happy now? And you're like, wow.
Yes.
That okay.
I was confusing this with a different film that had a kind of afterlife element to it, but I do know of The Knowing. I forgot it was called. Yes. This, yes, the ending is completely ridiculous. I remember thinking, oh, thank God the white kid survived. Phew. Also, how are those children going to survive in the wilderness with no one to protect them? I'm sure they'll be able to build shelter. Well done there, aliens. Good, well thought out plan there.
So, again, it's like another example of the Day the Earth Still reboot. It's like dickish aliens who just turn up and just go, ah, and then just like...
but, yeah, I mean, at least Knowing performs one useful function, which is that it means that X-Men Origins Wolverine isn't the worst movie of the year. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, can I just put out, why can't the aliens just turn up, take the children and go away? Why do they have to go, you're all going to die, you're all going to die, I told you. What's all that about? Moving on.
There are some pretty bad stuff here, though. 2012, oh my God. So actually, I quite like the Day After Tomorrow, where it was called, which was the kind of the thing that the people that made Independence Day went on and did. And I thought, like, I actually quite liked that because it wasn't the big, stupid, let's destroy the Earth thing. It had some thought. I know people will probably don't like it, but I quite like that. It's got stupid science in it, but still. And then they kind of went, oh no, let's forget about that. Let's go back to destroying the Earth again in like big, and it is really stupid. It is just
all the characters terrible. That I actually had any interest in surviving all died.
It has the thing that one of my pet hates with film is when the effects become so laughable and ludicrous. I'm looking at you, Jupiter Ascending, is that you feel like you're just watching a video game and therefore your level of threat has gone because you know that they'll survive it. And it starts like that with 2012. It's like, you know, there's John Cusack in a limousine driving, jumping through collapsing buildings, just managed to jump through the little gap there is as an entire structure collapses. I'm like, no. This, you'll be dead. This is pointless. Why are we even trying to imagine that you could survive this thing? And it's just like it goes on like that again and again. It's always, oh, and it's like, no, you're trying to create this like believable end of the world situation. And it's a cartoon. It's like none of this makes any sense at all. And it just keeps going on and on and on. It's just utterly awful.
I would say one good thing for about 2012 is that for a while, I think it managed to kill this disaster fetish movie type thing. I mean, you know, if you think about back to, you know, the days of Deep Impact and Armageddon and Volcano and all of these things, and of course with the previous years you had Poseidon and things like that. Yeah. 2012 kind of put a full stop on that, because once you've done the entire world going tits up.
Yeah, it goes far in terms of your show, definitely.
And now we're expected to trot along and watch Dwayne Johnson flying a helicopter through California and San Francisco, getting sucked into a hole in the ground. And I'm like, I mean, that's why I always thought this is a bad idea, San Andreas. But there we go.
Disaster movies, you're just like, it's like Towering Inferno. You're in a bad space and it's a survival thing to get out and survive it. Thing is, 2012, the entire world dies, and even if you survive, you've got to start over again with a load of rich assholes for company. So really, I might also, just to be a pedant here, the Mayan calendar does not predict the end of the world in 2012, and neither does the Bible. Thank you. Moving on.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so better explosions this year. We had the sequel to Crank, which is just as bonkers as Crank. In fact, more bonkers than Crank. Taking Pelham 1-2-3 is forgettable, but, you know, it happened, so we mention it. Gamer was, it's a good year for Neville Dean and Taylor to offend people with various levels of violence and weird cultural hijacking. Inglourious Basterds happened this year, Law Abiding Citizen, Ninja Assassin, which we've talked about before, but it happened, so I'm mentioning it. Robert Downey Jr. Was surprisingly good as action Sherlock.
Yeah.
Victorian action detective, and Taken revolutionized the approach to low budget horror in this year. So, I mean, now that I actually come to look at it, I think that your action fan was quite well served. I think that's where the I didn't really consciously do this. I was hurriedly making some schnokes, but I know that we always like to end on a high. And if we take out, you know, the forgettable moments such as Law Abiding Citizen, Ninja Assassin, and Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, there's plenty for people to enjoy I mean, you know, that's fine.
I've seen Sherlock Holmes. I saw it at Christmas time. It was a family outing film for this year after the abysmal Day of the Earth Stood Still last
year. Oh, well, you obviously were on the nice list this year instead of the naughty.
Yes, very good. Of the two Sherlock Holmes films we've had, this was my favourite. This one has a genuine mystery that has to be solved in the film, whereas the second one didn't really. You know, it just kind of had, look, Moriarty, everybody! In fact, I'm a bit pissed off they just killed off Irene Adler straight away at the beginning of the next, spoilers everyone, next Sherlock film, with very little commentary. I actually, believe it or not, I have not seen Taken, because I feel I've been told about it so much I don't really need to.
I mean, there's a difference between being told about Taken and watching it.
I saw it again recently and was enjoying it just as much. It's definitely, you know, it's a good one. You need to watch it.
Yeah, I think the thing about Taken is the glee with which it rides roughshod over. I mean, the point is that Taken is, you know, as I contend, modern pulp. And this just completely fits, it slips its foot into the glass slipper of pulp and just goes, there we go, see? And you know, it's the glee with which you watch the kind of the revenge unfold. And Liam Neeson brings just that, well, this kick-started Liam Neeson into that space.
Liam Neeson, this is what you'll be doing for the rest of your career.
So he didn't mind.
On with that.
Yeah, well, he's bringing some kind of gravitas to absolutely ludicrous kind of action suspense. Where it goes wrong, it tends to be with him these days, is that when the actual source material is quite hard-boiled to start with, he's not the right person, because he doesn't... What he needs to do is bring seriousness to ridiculous fluff, not... He's already serious enough. So if the material is quite unpleasant to start with, you need someone a bit lighter to be the man who walks down the mean streets. And ironically, Liam Neeson is too gritty for that. Is you see what I mean? You know, he's gritty for stupid stuff about, my daughter's been kidnapped and now I'm going to go and kill a whole bunch of French dudes. That's fine. But when it's like A Walk Among the Tombstones, where it's like, oh, everybody's miserable, people have drinking problems, blah, 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 and everything's really unpleasant. Weirdly, the person who gets away with stuff like that is someone like Nicolas Cage, because remember, he made 8mm, and it's just Nicolas Cage himself is so ridiculous that when the material is so dark,
you need some kind of juxtaposition of, you can't just have it all one way, is what you're saying, which makes sense, really, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like either the character has a lightness to them which ameliorates the darkness of the surroundings, or the character has a darkness to them which lends an air of seriousness to something that if someone else was, I mean, let's just reimagine Taken with Nicolas Cage in the lead role. That's funny. Yeah? It's a hilarious laugh fest. It's not serious at all. And that is the problem, you see, and that is what, so it's weird. It's like Liam Neeson and Nicolas Cage are two sides of the same coin. Ooh.
Well, there's a plot for next Face Off film, I think.
Face Off 2. They have a particular set of faces. Let's just take a moment to end on a glorious Technicolor high. High Voltage and Gamer came out this year. Now, I'm rather disappointed that Neville Dean and Taylor had this brief, I mean, it's a bit like Crank itself. They have this brief moment in the sun where they make all these horrendously offensive action movies, which are just hilarious to watch the old people get all their panties in a bunch about. Oh, he shoots the woman through her implants and then they think it's funny when all the blood and goo. Yes, it is funny because the whole film is like that. It's just this ridiculous. At one point in Crank, he has a fight with someone with a giant papier-mâché head on a model of a bloody electricity substation. It's meant to be some kind of cheap Godzilla ripoff. Crank is a film in which Jason Statham is a man with an electric heart who appears in flashbacks as a little kid, you know, little sort of chavvy kid with Jerry Halliwell as his mother. I mean, for God's sake, if you're worrying about the levels of violence in this movie, then you're watching the wrong bloody movie.
I have to say that I do. This is. I'm grateful of my friendship with Leo on this because I would. I'm not someone who would ever probably have ever gone and seen Jason Statham in anything. Certainly not these. And having done so, they are incredibly entertaining. The two of the crank are crazy, and I love them. They're just mad. I love them.
I think Gamer, which is kind of a little bit more serious, has Gerard Butler in it, so how serious can it be? But it actually has that kind of sci-fi edge. I mean, well, the first time I saw it, I thought, well, that's actually pretty bloody amazing. And then Sue, I went to take, it was that good. I went to see it twice and took Sue in to see it. When Sue went to see it, she said, yeah, it's not really human though, really, is it? And that's the big, I have to live with that, that later on you go, yeah, it says some important things about culture, but it does so without any kind of emotional heart. And that is a bit of a problem. And one of the things I really enjoy about it is the fact that critics absolutely hate them and cannot see what they are. I think in some ways these are films that are yet to have their day and they will bake and then one time around 2022 or something, someone will go, oh, remember those films? They were great. And suddenly there'll be these cult classics from history. But yeah, they're in that point at the moment where I was like, oh, who wants to watch that? The thing that lets you know that they're culturally relevant is the fact that so many people find them deeply offensive and advise people, warn them or say, don't watch this because it'll just make you angry and offensive. Not in a way that knowing does, where I say, no, literally, dude, you have, I mean, in a way, I say, if you want to watch that movie, you have to watch it all the way through to the bitter end because all the emotional payoff is in that last terribly offensive moment. Whereas these people are going, oh, never watch these movies. They're culturally worthless. And as soon as somebody says that, you know that somebody's made something culturally worthwhile because it's pushed their buttons. And if it pushes your buttons, it's not culturally worthless.
Is that an interesting note to end on?
So before we get quite to that moment of cracking open the champagne, we've come all the way 35 years, 1975 to 2009, and we've covered a lot of movies. But if there are movies that we haven't covered that people are like, well, what about this movie? Ian, where might they go to moan at us about this so that we can not listen to their feedback?
Well, one place they could go to give some belated feedback about how we should handle your movies would be our Facebook page. You can find it /Revenge of the 80s Kids. It is our community hub. We put up links to our podcast there, as well as links we find interesting. But podcasts are what it's all about, and for those want to point your web browser towards 80s kids, and that's 80s as in letters, so eighties kids.podomat.com. Please go there and subscribe to our podcast whilst you can, or download to your PC for dark reasons of your own. But this is only where our most recent podcasts can be found. For the legacy of our podcasts, you must go to the 80skidsblogspot.com, where you can find a full archive of all our shows ever, mostly. You can download them for your own amusement. Hundreds of shows there. This is not the only place you can find us. If you want to seek down individual 80s kids, you can go to such places as...
LeoStableford.com, where a bunch of stuff that I do is about. We've got loads of stuff. I mean, this is a good time to get into the LeoStableford.com business, because there's going to be videos, there's going to be novels, there's articles linked out. We're writing for Trash Mutant at the moment, and all sorts of exciting things are happening there. But all of that is pretty wordy stroke video-y. I don't really do drawings. If you want to look at sort of art, high art, beautifully hand-drawn illustrations of things like, I don't know, people having autopsies in the 19th century and whatnot. Where might they go to do that, Justin?
You will find plenty of examples of my art from my own things entertaining myself, or maybe some professional stuff as well, on my Deviant Art page, and that is under justinwhites.deviantart.com.
The fireworks have started and the music has begun. So, Leo, I'd like to sum up a little bit before we end. Now, we've just completed the whole decade of the noughties, and we ended in this decade with an awful lot of hope and enthusiasm. Thank God the 90s is over. But as we've trundled towards the end, we've definitely had a few years where we went, oh God, this was the year of those films. And so, actually, nostalgia has been chipped away slightly by the process of doing this little noughties reflection. How do you feel about the noughties as a whole?
I think that, what I've discovered is that the noughties was a time where when it was good, it was very, very good. And when it was bad, it was worse than the 90s. And I think what happens is that you go and see a good movie and it kind of buoys you up and you bounce along, and you forget so much easier, because that's the thing. Where the 90s had a shortcoming was that when it was good, it was all right, and that meant that when it was terrible, it was terrible, and therefore you go, wow, that was a decade of not much. I mean, remember when we did our top fives of the 90s, there was a lot of crossing over, a lot of the films came in the same place, so the things that were really, really deeply affecting were a little bit fewer and a little bit further between, whereas here there's plenty of value. I mean, you've got to remember that as well, film production went up, so you couldn't possibly see anything, it came down to, well, did you choose? If you chose well during these 10 years, there was 1 year in particular, 2007, where you would probably still end up with some stinkers, but overall you could go through entire years and not know that terrible Dreck was coming out at all, because the things you went to see were perfectly fine. And I think that's the way it is. When you actually sit down and look at the years, you go, oh my God, that movie, which you may have caught later on DVD or somewhere else, and that's why you suddenly have this bad taste in your mouth. But that's not such a big impact. As far as going to the cinema was concerned, you could pretty much pick and choose.
Absolutely. I mean, I think now is the time. I mean, there's so much. There is so much on the screen, and it doesn't last as long as it used to, that you do have the chance, and you can find out about, there's plenty of people like ourselves, ranting and raving about films. You can get a good sense of whether something's an utter stinker or not. So you can pick and choose now. I think it's suitable that we're looking, we've looked far back and have come to this point. Because now, we've got, the way cinema is now is built on these foundations of, the films we've talked about in the past. So now we have, and a pretty, it's a pretty firm footing for a lot of genres, which up until, the kind of the late 90s and noughties, just weren't going anywhere. But now we have, this kind of groundwork's being set in place. And sure, there'll be bad movies, there will be. There'll be terrible reboots. But, unless, you have no concept of films in the past or anything, you can avoid them, because there will be plenty of things to look forward to and see. So, I think, this, we've seen the journey of this over the last 35 years to the point now where we're living in a golden age of cinema. We are. How long it lasts, who knows, but we're going to enjoy it while we can.
I mean, I think what I would say from the whole journey is that it is definitely the case that, you know, we call this Revenge of the 80s Kids. We spent a long time in the 80s, obviously, what, 10 years. And what I note about the different flavour of the decade is that you get kind of the late 70s is where that kind of let's push everything and be really crazy kind of reached its natural death as things got really, really weird, you know, like Zardoz and things like that. And then in the 80s, what they did was they were definitely trying to make a business out of cinema, but they still didn't really know what was going to sell big. And so the 80s has the biggest amount of creativity. Like, as much as I'd like to say that, you know, creativity in the sense of like just raw invention is alive and well, there's not much evidence for that, really. The 2000s was the 10 years that Hollywood got to grips with digital. And that's what's written all over it. And what that means is that when it comes to like raw creativity, what they're having a problem with is that, you know, as budgets escalate and as it all goes a bit mental, they just have to be more and more conservative about the creative chances that they take. And everything's a reboot or a throwback. And the 80s didn't have that. The 80s had some actual imagination and invention. So it's not just nostalgia, kids. If you didn't live through the 80s and didn't have a chance to go to the cinema during that most wonderful of decades, you lost out. Ha ha, sucks to be you. That's not to say things are bad now. It's just that everything that's there is kind of a bit safer. Even the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which takes great risks in the way in its scope and its imagination, is based on a bunch of properties that are over half a century old. So
I think for me, really, the question I'm really left with after all this, and I've pondered on it for some time, is what the hell do we call the decade we're living in now? Is it the teenies? What is it?
Well, thankfully, we won't really have to worry about that because that's not where our ship is sailing. Due to the fact that, I mean, I think that there was definitely a case. It got to about 2005, 2006, and people were like, we were all like, well, okay. Now we're getting into this area where it feels like I only saw this last week. And we didn't. I mean, the fact that, you know, all of this stuff that we're looking at now is over 5 years old, half a decade, it doesn't... I mean, one of the weird things for me was when I saw that this is the year of X-Men Origins Wolverine. I think of that film as a very old and terrible moment in cinema history. And yet it's just as old as something like, you know, Crank High Voltage, which I see as a lot newer. And so, yeah, it's weird how time plays games with that.
It's quite sad because we have definitely followed the development of comic books over the years. And I suppose we should say that we should really say the pinnacle was Dark Knight in the previous year episode. It's a shame in many ways that our final iteration of a comic book movie is Wolverine Origins, the one that even X-Men pretends doesn't exist.
If we were making this in 2009, you know, then we may well be thinking, like, we're not really sure what's going to happen. Is Marvel going to be following it up? Is they going to...
Yeah.
But now we have the hindsight of looking back going, well, it's in good hands, you know.
Yeah, 2009
we were saying we have grim feelings about X-Men First Class.
Yeah, 2009 is a year which I think is brilliant in sort of a broader conceptual sense for ending the journey on because of the fact that there is absolutely nothing remarkable about it whatsoever. And it just serves to prove our point that we've had before, that with the exception of 1999, the year that changed movies, when the decade changes or you don't just suddenly go and now we're into this type of movie and the old decade takes a while to go away and so on and so forth. And this is exactly that. 2009, you know, just like 1989 has nothing particularly of note. And it's like, there's some bits and bobs, but it's a bit of a grab bag really. But that's what history is like. We do, you know, you think of the movies of the 80s and you know, some of the movies of the 80s are really movies of the 90s and some of them are movies of the 70s and some of the other movies that you think of aren't really, oh, is that in the 80s? God, wow, who would have thought? What I like about this year as an end point is its complete lack of any kind of signature hallmark. If we'd have finished in 2008 with Iron Man and Incredible Hulk coming out, that would have been like, and that's a full stop. But what's happened is we've kind of got three words into the next sentence and have gone, right, and now we're stopping. And that's the way history works, isn't it? You know, just it keeps rolling. And we've got, you know, all the things to come. Captain America, Thor, the first Avengers movie, blah, 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 blah. And, but they're in the future. And in 2009, if you just took that slab of films, there'd be no indication of what was to come. And I think that's something that we've learned during the journey as well. So there we go. Well, the realization, the enormity of that, the fact that we have in fact done what we set out to do all of those 2 years ago is starting to sink in. And I think it has made me recover sufficiently that now I can face our doom at the hands of our arch nemesis we've never met before, Mr. LeBuff. So let us get on with that. Directly after Indeed. The credits, is it? For those of you listening at home to all the chat about movies, though, bye-bye!
Farewell, my friends. It's been fun.
It's been awesome.
I should point out, we still do have the top fives to do.
We do.
So, you know.
Well, spoilers, there. We don't die. Thank you, Leah. Well done. Thank you. Brilliant. I put all this work into those bloody clips and tell them the end. Screw this. I'm going for a long walk on Frankston Beach to think about how I've wasted my time and reconsider what I'm going to do myself. So long.
I'll be in my Winnebago.
I'm obviously Mad Max, so bring it on.
Ah, yes. Discussion of the films of 2009 and the realization that our quest is at an end has brought me back to my senses. If I'm honest, I had thought that the realization of this achievement would have fewer shackles and less heavily armed killer robots, but still, top of the world, Mom. Hey, who's with me? Hey?
How touching. How very, very wonderful. And of course, pathetic and miserable. At last, 80s kids, you are forced to confront the consequences of your actions. How do you feel, tell me, knowing that you have wrought your own destruction?
Okay, I know I miss a lot of the shows during this run, so come on. Which of you two pissed this guy off so badly?
No, Justin, you don't understand. None of us know who this guy is.
No, I've come to my senses completely unaware who this weirdo is. I don't recognise the shiny knee boots, the swishy cloak, the light-up panel on his chest, or the paper bag on his head.
What is this? A final game? Your last measly attempt to best me? This pretense of ignorance? Even I did not think you could sink so low.
Or maybe we just don't know who the hell you are.
No matter, for now you are in my power, and I shall happily crush you in the service of my master and in the glory of my vengeance.
There is one reason why we don't know who we are, you know, and it would mean you can't kill us now.
Oh, and what is that?
We could be from your past, but you could be from our future.
Oh no, are things going to get timey-wimey? I hate it when that happens.
No. Things are not going to get timey-wimey, slimy, or even grimy. You will die, all of you, right now.
Don't panic. I can get us out of this. Follow me. This way!
Well, okay. It looks like Ian's running away, on the face of it cowardly, but, you know, I think cowardly is the new black.
Ditto!
You cannot escape me, 80s kids. I will have my revenge.
I've got a stitch. Quick, guys, in here.
Oh, this looks cozy.
I'm too scared to think.
Inside. Tighter. There.
I can't help but notice this is a maintenance closet.
I can't help but notice that this appears to be our only strategy in the face of imminent fatality.
Don't worry, I have it all under control. There, all done. There's no point. This bulkhead is reinforced. It'll take you about 6 hours to get through it.
But I have 6 hours, and you have nowhere to go.
Those both seem like excellent points.
They would be, if they weren't both utterly wrong.
Explain.
I used this console to tap into the ship's meta-narrative control device. We've had it set to ARC for the entire run of the series, so we could continue to fly away from Big Bay and towards, some form of help, maybe. But now LaBeouf is here, and the ARC is no good. If the episode ends in ARC mode, he'll still be right there waiting for us at the beginning of the next installment.
This still doesn't sound fun.
But I just moved the main setting from arc to episodic. What that means is at the end of every episode, the plot completely resets as if nothing had actually happened at all. Quite a few spacecraft use it because it smooths over personal tensions. It also means that when you're stranded in some far-flung corner of the galaxy with limited supplies, you can fly for up to 7 seasons and never run out of Lapsang Souchong in replication devices.
I think I see where this is going.
So, we don't have to defeat LaBeouf, really. The end of the episode will do that for him.
How long is it till the end of the episode?
Oh, not long now. About 10 seconds?
You bastard!
And there.